What I've already seen is that topics that transhumanists talk about, such as body hacking or life extension, even immortality, are actually really common in literature and in cinema. And in the context of literature and cinema, people talk about those things very openly. Oh, would you ever want to live forever? No, it would be a curse because of this or that. Or yes, because I fear death. Right? Those conversations are so acceptable in the realm of fiction. But if you actually bring them up as, let's have a political conversation about this, should we actually legislate this topic, then it seems very fringe. And so it's not like it's going to come into the political discussion from nowhere. I think that when this actually, if this comes into the political discussion, which I would say that it very well might, there's already such a huge body of literature and film to talk about it, and those things inform us about who we are. That doesn't just get thrown out the window.
That was Ford Fisher, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. The All Things Risk podcast is my show, my project, where I go long form with fascinating people, and I use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to get into all kinds of topics. And one of the types of conversations that I have are very much in the bucket of big picture discussions. So things like current affairs, the state of the world, the media, the environment, that type of thing. And today's episode definitely belongs in that category. So to kick things off, I wanted to ask a question, and that is, what happens when science fiction meets science fact? And in particular, I'm thinking about where human meets machine. If we think about movies like The Matrix and Blade Runner, that type of thing. We are starting to live in this world. Scientists, for example, have started to grow brain cells in circuit boards. Didn't know that before I researched this episode. You can buy a headset through which you can control a laptop with your mind. There's a thing called gene engineering, where companies are looking at ways to eradicate disease through editing of genes. We've got artificial intelligence. And all of this stuff, if you extend it, raises a number of interesting questions about risk, about morality, ethics, and even fundamental questions about what it means to be human. And in fact, there is an entire movement that aims to transform humanity by using technology to make us more intelligent, more capable, and even to expand our lifespans. And it's called transhumanism. And in fact, in the US, there's even a political party dedicated to this. So I think we're going to be hearing more and more about this movement over the coming years. And my guest today is embarking on a mission to better understand the movement and to provide us with an objective grassroots view of what it's all about. I want you to meet Ford Fisher. Ford is a videographer, an editor, a computer scientist. He's based in Washington, D.C. He's produced documentaries, interviews, and he's the co-founder of a site called News to Share. And he is working on a documentary on transhumanism called Transhuman. And in fact, that political party that I mentioned, the Transhumanist Party, has or had a presidential candidate, Zoltan Istvan, who is an advisor to Ford's project. He's in the process of looking for funding. We'll get into that. We'll get into the project. But this is a fascinating conversation about transhumanism. We start with what it is, and we get into the different aspects of it: super wellness, super intelligence, super longevity, where we are with the technology. And then we get into things like body hacking, gene engineering, this concept of singularity, which is all about downloading or uploading our consciousness into computers. We then explore some of the bigger questions around all of this. What risks are there? What does this mean for politics? What does it mean for conflict? Where's all of this going? It's as I mentioned, a fascinating conversation. We end, of course, with Ford's project, his documentary, and how you can support. And by the way, you can go to allthingsrisk.co.uk to find out more. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go into the world of transhumanism with Ford Fisher. So, Ford, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
Where are you dialing in from?
I'm actually dialing in from Washington, D.C., which is my sort of home base for the last 5 years.
Yeah. So that gets into a little bit of your background. We're going to talk about transhumanism and your project, but I wanted to explore your background a little bit because you're a videographer. You started this thing called News to Share, and I wanted to explore that a little bit. And, you know, what is your background? And
sure. So I've been in Washington, D.C. for 5 years, and for the first 4 years of it, I was actually attending American University. But my sophomore year at AU, I co-founded a company with a guy named Trey Yingst called News2Share.com. And the website essentially allows anybody to contribute content to it. Anybody who shoots original video that has news value can send it to us. But in practice, most of the content on there is shot by myself, the co-founder, and a few other people who have worked sort of directly with us. And the majority of what it is covered, largely based on access, but also it's sort of become a beat for us, is politics and activism. Mm-hmm. There are protests in Washington, D.C. for every single reason, nearly every single day. Mm-hmm. And so I've met a real cross-section of people who are very passionate about individual specific topics, and that's driven me to be very, very interested in politics and alternative politics, right? People who go out there and protest aren't generally protesting for moderacy. They're not usually out there protesting for...
Although that might change in a few days, but yeah.
The status quo.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, and yeah, no, yeah. And I mean, and in the face of extremism, they may be protesting to get it back, but protest is always for change. It's always for dismissal of whatever the status quo is right now. And so because I've experienced a lot of that, I've seen a lot of people with a lot of really, really different and outside of the kind of traditional two-party system sort of thinking.
And was it your experience or your view that led you to start this this work, that some of these movements weren't getting enough coverage, they weren't being brought into the debate? Where does some of that come from?
I think that the mainstream media tends to be kind of dismissive of debate outside of what is kind of pre-prescribed as what the debate should look like. There's this very simple kind of Republican versus Democrat way of thinking that, and in large part, I think this is why we had Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both being fairly successful, right? Donald Trump has not historically been a Republican, and he doesn't represent much of what Republicans say they do. And Bernie Sanders just switched back to independent after running as a Democrat. And so, you know, of course, Bernie didn't get his nomination, but Donald Trump got the whole presidency. But the success of both of those movements show that people are very disappointed with the sort of status quo. And I think the mainstream media, at least until it was inevitable, might have believed that this was going to be Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, right? This kind of, you know, something that Bush v. Clinton, like we haven't done this before, you know, that there's this very, very status quo way of thinking about politics. I think the difference about Trump and why the media kind of ate him up is just simply because he's entertaining. It's because of ratings, and he kind of broke that trend. But people who are interested in the Palestinian side of that conflict, or people who are really, really, really intense enviro activists, you know, beyond what the Democrats would want, or, you know, people who are in militias, you know, not just, oh, you know, we kind of rhetorically support gun rights, but we're in militias. People who are kind of that extreme and then go out on the streets, they tend not to be looked at a whole lot by the mainstream media. But if you cover it, and if news sort of happens, the mainstream media ends up taking a look at it. I once was the only person filming a panel that Oliver Stone was speaking at, and ultimately Bill O'Reilly actually used it on his show. But Fox didn't actually have a camera there. It was just that they saw the footage and then took it.
Yeah, and there's I don't know if you're familiar with the term the Overton window. Which is,
I don't know that term.
Yeah, it's a political science term. I studied political science way back. So it's but it's what is acceptable to talk about, and you know, if you think about 20 years ago, you know, gay marriage, you know, LGBTQ rights, you know, all of those things were not in the window. And what happens is, my understanding of it, if I can recall correctly, basically that window starts to you start to stretch and push that window, and things go in it that move into that conversation, but it takes, you know, it takes time and it takes effort and people like yourself to try and make that happen. But waiting for the mainstream media to do it, it would seem to me as a non-starter nowadays. But we'll see what happens.
Right, and so for me, so transhumanism, which I'm now making this film about, transhumanism right now appears to be completely outside of that window.
Yeah,
there's almost no political discussion about anything. Mm. And we're going to get into what this actually means, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no political discussion about that movement. The reason that I'm making a film about it is I believe that that's going to come into the window, the Overton window that you just described. And I would like to have covered that movement before everybody is looking to cover it. I want them to be able to look back and see what they were before they were in the spotlight.
Right. It feels like it's, and we'll start to get into it. It feels like this is a concept that's starting to enter into those kind of fringe discussions. You can find more about it in podcasts and things like this. But I hadn't realized before doing a little bit of research for this conversation that the concepts have been around for a while. The 80s and 90s, and it just seemed like, you know, the realm of very, very fringe, almost almost. And some of the stuff, even when you read about it, and life extension and body hacking, it comes out of, you know, it seems like it comes out of science fiction. But I think it's now time to start to have that discussion as slowly as it may be to enter into the mainstream debate.
So what's interesting is I actually studied film and not news or journalism or broadcast. I studied film in the context of fiction and narrative film, which has a lot of overlap to documentary and news, but it's a different art. And what I've already seen is that topics that transhumanists talk about, such as body hacking or life extension, even immortality, are actually really common in literature and in cinema. And in the context of literature and cinema, people talk about those things very openly. Oh, would you ever want to live forever? No, it would be a curse because of this or that. Or yes, because I fear death, right? Those conversations are so acceptable in the realm of fiction. But if you actually bring them up as, let's have a political conversation about this, should we actually legislate this topic, then it seems very fringe. Mm. And so it's not like it's going to come into the political discussion from nowhere. I think that when this actually – if this comes into the political discussion, which I would say that it very well might, there's already such a huge body of literature and film to talk about it, and those things inform us about who we are. That doesn't just get thrown out the window. People will review what they thought of Blade Runner or Star Wars in their head before they make their conclusion about, you know, about what counts as human, what counts as immoral to – due to one's body.
Yeah, it's a soft way of introducing a topic, I suppose, and in that sense, fiction has a very important place to play, science fiction in particular. Let's start maybe, or let's get into transhumanism and just maybe start with what it is.
Right.
Can you just take us to the basics of it?
Sure. So transhumanism is pretty loosely defined. I mean, it's a movement, and a lot of different people within transhumanism have a lot of different things that they associate with it. But generally speaking, it's a movement of people who believe in using technology to change the human body and mind, essentially to evolve humanity with technology. And as it's applied, I break that up, and many others would, into sort of three distinct but overlapping categories. One is super well-being, which is people hacking their body to add functionality to their physical self. And that could be either by physically changing something or by editing one's DNA or a future a child's DNA. There's also, and of course, many of these things are theoretical, but many of them have begun to happen.
Right.
In there is also super longevity, which is people who perform transhumanist science or would like to, with the goal of living for as long as possible.
Wow. Yeah.
With the ultimate goal being immortality, I should abridge that. People use the word immortality, but many of them prefer to use the term indefinite lifespan, because what they mean is not that somebody is involuntarily forced to live forever, but simply that death is an option when they want it. So it's very different from this vision of immortality kind of as a curse, but more just that somebody will not have to die involuntarily would be the kind of ultimate goal. And then lastly, there's super intelligence, which is a little bit more abstract and doesn't really exist in any meaningful way yet other than theoretically. But this is people who want to change their minds using technology to somehow hack their brains or integrate computers with their minds. And so examples of this, because it's kind of hard to imagine without giving an example, examples could be attempting to store memories on RAM drives, attempting to augment the brain with some kind of a chip that would give it either more capacity or amplify its abilities, you know, or in the very extreme, to be able to upload one's entire consciousness or mind into a computer. And of course, we can go through all of this, but all of these come with very, very intense moral questions about what it means to be human, what it is immoral, what could be immoral, what could be dangerous, what could cause risk.
Yes. Well, I thought one of the ways we could tackle this is maybe if we go through the three different areas and maybe first just think about, well, what's the state of the technology now? And how far off are we? And then maybe we can then expand the conversation out to some of these, you know, moral and ethical questions.
Sure.
So just thinking about, so let's, you know, just picking the whole super intelligence concept. And is this what, when people say singularity, is that what they mean by it?
Right. So in the same way that immortality would be considered the ultimate, you know, highest level of longevity, in terms of super intelligence, the highest level, I guess, would be the singularity, would be the sort of, and it's, and again, this is a word that's very loosely defined. It's hard, that's a whole conversation into itself, but singularity more or less could be defined as the point at which, computer and human minds are, almost indistinguishable from one another, are connected to the point of being kind of one, or in defined another way, the point at which computers actually exceed the abilities of humans. So there's some debate over what the term even means.
Right. I read somewhere that there are scientists who have taken brain cells and have integrated them into a computer circuit or something like this, and it sounds, so even that sounds incredibly trippy, but although it does also sound very preliminary in this whole thing, this whole singularity thing sounds to me like it, and I'm not a technologist, but it sounds to me like it's very far off, but I'm curious what some of the some of the people you're speaking to or planning on speaking to, what they might think.
So it seems that because there's a lot less application of this so far, people are a little bit less focused on it. It seems that people tend to be focused on what's practical, and I use the word practical kind of loosely, but what they can actually make progress on.
Right.
The average person does not have the ability in their garage to, right. Somebody in their garage can inject a microchip into their hand, but someone in their garage cannot perform some kind of a brain surgery to upload their consciousness onto the internet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit too far away. However, the very, very, very simple experiments I've seen to this effect so far that have been demonstrated is they have shown, in one case, there was a scientist who managed to actually connect certain wires to someone's brain and had them picture something in their head and actually were able to put, and it was really, really blurry and it totally, like, it didn't even look like the thing, but they were able to kind of emulate what the thing looked like. And it essentially just had the correct color palette. It really didn't show, it didn't look like a picture at all.
No.
But the person was imagining kind of scenery and the computer was kind of able to like get the color of what they were thinking about. In another example, I have seen scientists were able to connect a computer to a woman's brain such that she was very, with great difficulty able to move the mouse by thinking about it. And so the point in these technologies is that they're so rudimentary, they're so undeveloped at this point that there's pretty much no application right now.
Sure.
But what they do show is that our brains as electric systems, as technology goes on, could be integrated to computers. That mm-hmm. technology certainly could exist. It's not an abstraction that could happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that right now those little tiny developments pretty much just serve the purpose of showing this could happen down the road. Mm-hmm. And of course, the risk associated with that, the issues associated with that, is what happens if the computer decides that it wants to control your brain, right? Yeah. What if the mouse decides where you should go? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a very Terminator kind of nightmare.
Yes.
Question.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's all kinds of implications, you know, and also softer ones. You know, people already criticize this generation for spending, you know, 12 hours with their face in a computer screen or their iPhone. You know, if you actually had your technology implanted directly into your brain, imagine the similar criticism from the older generation saying, these kids like can't get the computers out of their brain. I mean, yeah. literally they can't get the computers out of their brain.
Yes. Yeah. It's, I mean, even though what you described, just a computer being able to map colors based on someone's thoughts, that's incredible to me. That's, you know, we're far off, but that's, you know, I'm not sure. I've never really thought about it, but it's not something that I wouldn't have thought that would have been possible 10 years ago. It sounds like quite an advancement. So
everything in our body and our brain are systems, and we've created computer systems that are completely independent of that. It's not unreasonable to think that just like a USB universal serial bus can plug into pretty much anything. You know, I plugged my SD card from my camera into my computer, and now my computer and my camera have effectively shared, you know, data. It's not unreasonable to think that with time, there could be a much more direct link in a similar way.
Right. Okay. I mean, that's a good place to start. Maybe we can work through some of the other two areas a little bit and then, you know, bring it back to some of these bigger questions. But I've read or heard that you're going to be spending some time in a body hacking event?
Right. Yes. Sure. So on January 26th, my mm-hmm. fundraiser on Indiegogo mm-hmm. ends. And then on January 27th, I'm going to be flying with a co-producer of mine named Alejandro Alvarez mm-hmm. To Texas, where there is a body hacking conference. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's an assembly of mm-hmm. people who are interested in editing their bodies in one way or another. And that ranges from as simple and mainstream as tattoos to as extreme as injecting microchips and LED lights under one's skin for various, you know, purposes. And there's even one person I'm really hoping I'll be able to interview who at one point actually lost an eye, and he has put, instead of a glass eye or something like that, he's actually put a camera into the eye socket that moves around as his eye would, and it doesn't connect to his brain. It's not like he can see through it, but it actually records what his eye would see because he's able to move it around in conjunction with his other eye that works. And he calls himself Eyeboard. So, you know, that's a really, really extreme case, but so, you know, and all places in between. And included there are going to be the first night, there's actually going to be a so-called cyborg fashion show. They're going to, just like the, say, Victoria's Secret fashion show, but instead of showing off, you know, underwear, they're showing off a technology that's been integrated into their bodies on a runway.
Wow. Where are we in terms of, I mean, is there anyone that has had microchips implanted and are able to...
Yes.
Yes, okay. Very keen to hear about that.
Sorry, you didn't finish your sentence.
So I go back to childhood or, sort of childhood references to, or not even childhood references, but to sci-fi and, cyborgs and The Matrix and, cyberpunk and, all of these kinds of genres of science fiction. And the whole thing about implanting, whether it's a USB drive or some type of, computer human interface into your body, mm-hmm. That makes you able to do certain things is fascinating to me. And I'm just pure curiosity. How far off are we from that? And what are some people doing?
Right. So, I would point first to the transhumanist presidential candidate. So the transhumanists have actually started a political party called the Transhumanist Party. And I can talk a lot more about that in a bit. But the presidential candidate and the founder of the party, Zoltan Istvan, who's actually an advisor on my film, has a microchip that he implanted into his hand that allows him to put his hand up to his car door, up to his house door and up to his computer to unlock any one of those things. So it's a very, very simple device. It's not some kind of crazy GPS thing or connecting him to, any crazy, crazy stuff, but it's basically a very simple, digital key, not unlike a fob that someone would use to get into an apartment building. The difference is essentially just that it's under his skin. And so the technology now allows people to do that, where either they can have a unique identifier in a chip like that, or that they're able to store data of some kind under their skin. Right. And most of this technology isn't that rough. Nobody's so impressed by a fob to enter an apartment building.
We've been doing
the difference
that
is just now it's under your skin.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say we've been doing that with pets for a while, right? People microchipping their pets.
Right. And we wouldn't say that the fact that we have GPS chips in our pets makes us, in a transhumanist age. Or in, I guess with dogs, like a trans canine age.
Yes. That raises interesting questions. Can we take our pet's consciousness with us into the world of singularity? But anyway,
right? No, and that would be a fascinating topic as well. But at least for the moment, transhumanism by its definition tends to be focused on humans. Or current humans who want to somehow become post-human. But I don't think we're so much focusing on cyborg animals at this point.
No. One of the other
the funny intersection is that I was going to make sort of just like a joke here, which is that the funny intersection actually is that in movies like Terminator, the animals, the dogs always know when somebody's like actually a cyborg. Like even when they're dressed in human skin, like the dog always knows it's actually like an alien or a robot or whatever. Every movie, the animals are much more aware than humans are.
No, it's hence the need to think about this, right? genetic engineering is another area, right? That and there's CRISPR, right? Which is can you explain CRISPR?
It's interesting because there's actually two distinct uses for the word CRISPR. One is that there actually is a company called CRISPR Therapeutics, and that company uses what is called CRISPR technology, and CRISPR technology is also being utilized and experimented with other companies. So it's always worth when talking about CRISPR, it's always worth defining: are we talking about the company of CRISPR, or are we CRISPR Inc., or are we talking about the actual just the technology? So CRISPR is, and I had to look this up. This isn't from memory. Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. And that probably is meaningless to anybody who doesn't actually study biology. But essentially what CRISPR technology is a tech that allows when DNA splits, when cells split, and thus the DNA process, as we kind of learned about in maybe eighth grade science, the DNA splits, and then, it's in two halves. Every you know, there's only four different like chemicals in the DNA, and each one is matched with a different one. They're paired up, so the DNA splits in half, and then it knows what to add based on the half that it already has. Mm. And then that's how we grow. That's how our cells grow and duplicate. CRISPR is a technology that would allow people to digitally edit DNA in its process of splitting. So this would allow somebody to edit a living cell's DNA at the point of replication. Mm. In practice, what this means is that a new organism or an organism that is sort of rapidly growing could be edited. So at this point, it has not really been experimented on humans, to our knowledge, although we also don't know. China actually has done a lot of – is kind of leading on experiments with this, and it's not entirely clear what exactly they've done so far. But in mice, they have successfully managed to edit the DNA of a mouse to make the mouse baby have DNA that is different than the DNA of its two parent mouses. And so CRISPR, the company, CRISPR Inc., CRISPR Therapeutics Inc., their goal, what they say, is that they're trying to use gene edit, trying to basically make use it for the purpose of disease prevention or curing. That cancer essentially occurs when a cell has messed up DNA that causes it to replicate uncontrollably. If you could use CRISPR technology, you could tell the cell, stop being a cancer cell, right? Duplicate as normal cells. Or you could flatly edit a fetus's DNA so that they don't have a predisposition to cancer in the first place.
Right.
And so those are the really early applications. That corporation, if asked, would not claim themselves to be transhumanists. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to give people the ability to customize their DNA so that they can grow like a third eye or like four hands or something.
Right.
Right. They're trying to do it just for the sake of – they're trying to make themselves appear to be mainstream medicine. Many transhumanists, though, point to this technology that already exists, and they say, okay, this is actually the editing of humanity via technology. So this sort of matches our definition of what transhumanism is. But as applied to the actual goals of a transhumanist, if this technology becomes really, really, really mainstream and really usable, what if somebody could do a home lab and very simply edit their own DNA? What if somebody actually wanted to change their own eye color, right? And right now there's no way that would work because it only works on a replicating cell. So a fully grown person could not change their DNA with the technology that exists now, even if it was better. Mm-hmm. But it's not unreasonable to think that sometime down the road that could happen, or that in the more near future somebody could edit the DNA of their fetus. And so this gets into very, very interesting moral questions, like, is it wrong to edit the DNA of your child?
Yeah.
I ran a Facebook sort of poll about this among my my friends list, which is in no means a cross section of all of humanity. But generally speaking, the discussion seemed to be, well, I asked them, would you, if you had the ability to edit the hair or eye color of your baby in vitro, would you? And it was mostly either pretty hardcore libertarians or really, really, really progressive leftists who were in favor of it. The majority were against, but the other consensus seemed to be that almost everybody agreed that DNA editing for the sake of disease prevention is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And what I derive from that is that there's clearly some middle point between those of what could society find acceptable if we had the technology to edit DNA. Everyone agrees that disease prevention is perfectly fine. Most people are against purely cosmetic DNA editings.
Right.
But what's kind of in the middle? Predisposition to having a good intelligence, maybe editing height, right? Those have functional things that aren't that wouldn't be seen as eugenic, but it falls down a very slippery slope. Particularly getting into socioeconomic issues.
Yes.
Could you end up with all of the rich people get to edit their kids to be very, very healthy, and all the poor people have essentially this kind of under race physically.
Yes.
There's all kinds of issues that could there come are. From this applied, you know, a century into the future.
Yeah, you get into this debate around designer babies, and everyone's going to be, you know, that have access to this technology is going to be, you know, 6 foot five, and you know, whatever is the, you know, the trend, trends for beauty. What is also interesting to me, just listening to you describe this, that, you know, there's this line between gene editing for disease prevention is acceptable, but for other purposes, maybe not so. But once a technology like this becomes more widely available, like all technologies, there's a risk of, you know, a black market, right? You know, fine, we're using this to prevent, to remove cancer cells or cancer, cancer genes from gene pools. But, you know, what happens when, you know, there's a black market for it, and people that are super wealthy get access to it, or, you know, or this kind of thing, it starts to really open up some very interesting questions.
Right. Yeah. And then those are this is the issue of basically anything that is outlawed in a society. Mm. So if we look forward and we say, okay, well, maybe you kind of have a conservative religious swing in politics, maybe they would try to ban transhumanist science. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, we had a prohibition on drugs, and you know, that has the war on drugs, drugs are winning.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think it's and I think that there's a fundamental part of human nature that is to expand oneself, to make oneself the best that they can be, right? So think about how much people in a black market fight for drugs, which I would say mostly make people less than they are now. So imagine how motivated people would be to get illegal products that make themselves better than they are now.
Yes.
Right. This would be it would almost be like the forbidden fruit on the tree of knowledge, that you have the god or the state saying that you don't have this. But there will be that the slithering snake telling you, no, you need to unblind yourself. I just thought of that analogy, but I think it's a really good one. I should use that in the movie somehow. Right, that I don't think that the state can really prevent these sorts of developments, but it really, really can guide the way that they happen. I think most people would probably agree that black market transhumanism is probably more dangerous than a legitimate, culturally accepted and discussed form of transhumanism.
But it does, you know, it does raise questions, as you said, you know, and I note that you are a libertarian, and you know, anything that gets outlawed, banned, you know, that does create a black market for it. It creates some very interesting questions around politics. Well, let's maybe talk a little bit about politics, and transhumanism. So, Zoltan Istvan, did I get the surname correct?
Zoltan Istvan.
Yep. Who was the presidential candidate for the Transhumanist Party in the United States. And I'm just, you know, maybe we just start with the political platform of Zoltan and the party and what they're advocating.
Right. And so he's originally actually what got me hooked onto this topic. I had not heard of transhumanism until August of 2016. I was delivered a Facebook ad that said, join the Transhumanist Party. And I think it was because I had actually just joined the Libertarian Party.
Right.
I left the GOP because their platform was really backwards. And, you know, at least as far as I don't want to, you know, disparage anybody who is on your path. But at least for me, and the reason the party to begin with, and Trump did not represent the so often I'm Libertarian Party. And so right when that happened, I think Facebook's like, oh, this guy is interested in politics, whatever. Facebook kind of knows you too well.
Yeah.
And it served me this ad for the Transhumanist Party. And I looked into that. I had never heard the term before. And I was instantly very fascinated. And I ended up doing an interview with Zoltan for News to Share. It's one of actually the only text interviews I've done. I haven't I usually almost everything on News to Share is video, but I actually have an article, you know, a written interview with him. But we talked about why did you bring this into the political sphere? Because when I read his platform and I read what he was talking about, it actually didn't seem like a overtly political issue. But he made the case that First of all, movements like these don't end up getting into the spotlight until they get politicized. When you have something of such great kind of importance and moral questions, it's inevitably going to end up in politics. Somebody will try to fight it. And so people point to actually the stem cell fight as kind of the precursor to the type of political fights that could be had over transhumanism. That in the case of stem cells, it was most people on the left, not all, but most people on the left supported it. Either they wanted a government to aid stem cell research, or at the very least, they wanted the government to get out of the way. And then you had people on the right either saying, well, we want to eat – you know, at most we don't want to fund this, or we want to even like ban it altogether. And it seems that a similar trend could occur with transhumanism in the future. And I actually read Zoltan's book called The Transhumanist Wager, and it lays out — it's fiction, but it's very obviously kind of a futurist prediction of what the world could be. It lays out that that America becomes extremely skeptical of transhumanism as a movement, and there's kind of a left and libertarian defense of it against the state, and then there's kind of this like conservative backlash trying to very specifically defund or even criminalize the entire science. And that seems probably feasible, given that we've historically seen a pretty similar trend on abortion and then stem cells, which both allude to issues of bodily autonomy and science.
Right. What's interesting is, I mean, it is similar, as you say, to the, you know, say the abortion debate, but what strikes me is being very different and disrupting the game quite a lot, potentially, depending on where the technology goes. If we're talking about things like immortality or just life enhancement, the ability to sort of biohack your way to longevity, to super intelligence, that's a threat to the state, right? That's a threat to governments, because, you know, individuals become more, you know, more powerful than the state. And, you know, the question becomes, do we need the state?
Right. And so that would be the question asked by these kind of anarchist wing of the transhumanists. Yeah. And what's interesting is, so if somebody is in transhumanism, I haven't really seen any a transhumanist moderates, kind of like what I just said about how people who are out there on the street tend to be kind of extreme in some position just in order to care enough to go out there. Transhumanists tend, from my experience, speaking with a broad brush here, but tend to be fairly politically extreme or alternative in one way or another. So some people make transhumanism their primary focus, just of all their politics. But the rest of them, it kind of ranges from — I have heard of people refer to themselves as transhumanist socialists, and that would be the viewpoint that the government has an inherent role that they have to play in making sure everyone gets the technology, so that you don't end up with kind of a social and physical inequality of high tech rich people and low tech poor people. There's kind of the — Zoltan is in the libertarian to left libertarian wing, and that's sort of what the Transhumanist Party represents. If you read their platform, they have economic policies. It's not just an entire platform of we want to be robots, please let us be robots. Their platform includes looking forward to automation in the workforce and how that could be changed. So he has some tenets of kind of conservative or libertarian-ish economic policy, such as low as possible and as flat as possible of taxation. But he also includes a proposal that I've seen a lot of common ground politically, sort of all over the spectrum, for a universal basic income. His idea is that the government and society itself would automate so much that we would have all this value, all these products created, government could happen with at very low cost, that they wouldn't have to tax very much at all, and society would have a lot of output without a lot of labor, and therefore the government could afford to very easily provide a universal basic income. To people who don't know, there's variations on this proposal, but UBI is essentially giving $10,000 to every single person in the country before without any discretion as to whether they need it, rich or poor or whatever. And right. if somebody has a tax liability of greater than $10,000, then it just goes against that. So mm-hmm. It has an economically progressive outcome in that to a poor person, getting $10,000 is an enormous welfare. But to a rich person who owes a $10 million tax burden, the $10,000 means nothing. So mm-hmm. it actually has appeal to the right because it's completely flat mm-hmm. in terms of its application. And it has obvious appeal to the left because as it relates to income, it has an economically highly progressive effect. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of his platform. Policies regarding safety measures for AI, mm-hmm. Funding science. He's called himself the science candidate. All in all, mm-hmm. I would say with the addition of cyborgism, his party politics probably falls somewhere between the Libertarian Party and the Green Party,
right.
somewhere kind of in the middle of that area. But very, very, very personally, in terms of personal freedom, personal liberty, very libertarian in nature, that the entire premise is I own my body and I have the right to do whatever I want with it. And it is sort of considered the ultimate aggression or violation of rights for somebody to deny me my right to try to be immortal or physically as able as possible.
Right. That's really interesting. And it does make sense. I think it makes makes a lot of sense for this to enter into the political debate, and certainly in the United States, where technology, the United States is at the forefront of technology, and I would imagine here in the UK we would follow suit. But yes, it's really fascinating stuff. But at the same time, it's the working assumption to me of transhumanists is that the technology will exist or will progressively or maybe follow some kind of a power law type of progression where it's just going to get better and more accessible, and that's not necessarily a wrong assumption, but it also
right.
There may be some aspects to it that that strike me as perhaps a little bit religious at the far the far end of it. Singularity will be the technology of the future, or the way in which the consciousness future consciousness will be, and it will always be the technology of the future, right? So
there's I would say that this is definitely on a spectrum within the transhumanist movement. So on the very, very practical, very short-term side of things, there's body hackers who it's not really about these abstract concepts, but literally it's just mm-hmm. like, what can I add yeah. to my body? Mm-hmm. What can I do with my body right mm-hmm. now? Mm-hmm. It's worth noting that Body Hacking Con that I'm going to be going to, while transhumanist in nature, only 30% of their attendees actually identify
right.
as transhuman.
Right.
Many of them would prefer a term like cyborg. They're not saying right. that they're not human. They're just cyborg. They're just
right.
They're after computerizing.
They're after right. the practical aspects of what is it that not necessarily practical.
Right.
It's not always practical to have an LED, light in in your body. But
right.
what can I practically do with my body and experiment with my body, which I can understand.
Right. In the extreme, right. And actually, I would probably compare this to the psychological concept of the locus of control, which is that somebody who has an internal locus of control believes that they have control over everything kind of in their life. It's somebody who takes
right.
responsibility for
right.
everything that happens to them. An external locus of control is saying, what happens to me is a result of everything else, and I have no autonomy. And of course, most people are somewhere in the middle. I can't control how everyone else treats me, but I can control my own actions, so it's somewhere in the middle. Religiousness is the most external locus of control because it's somebody saying God controls everything, right? God had a plan when, my relative dies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So in a similar way that you're saying, some of them almost act kind of religious about this concept where it's a very external locus of control. It's I'm not experimenting. I'm not trying to make the singularity happening. It's just almost like a worshiping. And the reason I say that is in Florida, and this is one of the places that I really hope to visit, and I have a connection, and I'm pretty sure that I will be able to. There's actually a church called the Church of Perpetual Life, and this is a transhumanist church where people get together. It's an atheistical church where people get together, and they basically talk about and sing about and worship the concept of immortality. The kind of like concepts of immortality, of singularity, and it's led by, I think the man's name is Bill Falloon, and their entire thing is they have a church devoted to the concept of life extension. But they're not getting together. It's not like a working garage where they get together and try to invent it.
Yes.
You know, they talk about healthy habits. They talk about extending their life now as much as possible. But when interviewed by Vice, some of the attendees were saying, and these were like 50-year-old women, were saying, we truly believe we will never die because immortality will be reached before we're gone. And that seems to me to be, on a spectrum of from wishful thinking to straight up death denial, right? Everybody has a tendency to say, I want to live forever. So in the extreme, could somebody be taken advantage of to tell them, you know, come worship immortality with me and here's the collection plate? I don't know.
Yeah, that strikes me as a pure...
I'd really like to find out.
Yeah, that sentiment strikes me as pure faith, right? Just a pure article of faith. But it is, you know, it would be fascinating if you get to speak to that church, that group, for a number of reasons. One of the things that I've been thinking about in preparation for this interview is just the whole concept of immortality. You know, don't we need death? Don't we need the concept of death to give, you know, some type of meaning to our lives? If we know that we're here for a finite period of time, doesn't that make, our energy that we expend more meaningful? And if life carries on infinitely, why don't I become a crack addict next week and see how that works out? And, it's all good,
I've heard of people make this argument to Zoltan. I've listened to him on several podcasts, and the thing that he's kind of said to this idea of like you need death to fully enjoy life is he kind of just says like that's baloney.
Okay. okay.
So it appears that the concept of life could actually be more well lived if not preoccupied with. If not preoccupied with death all the time, that if somebody were able to actually focus on what it is they want to be doing, that they might actually be able to live life more fully. But additionally, that he emphasizes that he's not trying to create a sort of world of people who live forever. His hope is that people can live indefinitely, where death becomes a choice that they do at the time that feels right for them. So we're preoccupied with death right now because maybe we have this perception that if we know exactly, when we're going to die, then we're always going to be counting down. But that if I know I will never get some disease, I will be able to die exactly when I want. Having that control over it allows me to kind of live my life the most fully. That's at least what he would what he would claim. The reverse end of that argument is if somebody says, I have all the time I want, then they might actually just do nothing. They might just sit there, and be a bum, right? That they just, that they say, I have forever, right? What use do I have to go to school? I can just do it later.
Yeah.
That they won't go through the processes of life. I think that that's something that you could have very honest debate on multiple directions, whether society would be more or less productive in an age where lifespans are indefinite and people could die whenever they actually want to. There's definitely a cultural drive or an emotional drive that says it would be very nice to be able to choose to die with, my spouse at the same time. Right. That maybe the sadness of getting old. Right. My grandparents are 93 and 91. My mom has always said that, they would probably end up going within months of each other, that they've been married 69 years. They like their point of living is each other.
Yeah.
But imagine in the abstract if people who have been married for that long, right, that maybe they'd actually be able to say we're ready to go together now. And there is something almost romantic or fulfilling, or that would feel like a life most lived for them to go into like that. That would at least be what a transhumanist might tell you.
Yes, yes. What does Zoltan think of the potential for inequality to be, you know, grossly, you know, enhanced, exacerbated, you know, the rich being able to use these technologies, the poor, you know, not having access to them, and you get, you get extreme polarization.
So I've heard him talk about this as well, and his answer has tended to be that the short term way that we see that playing out is, what if workforce automation takes away all of the jobs that low income or low skill workers could have done? That rich people own all of the corporations, the resources, the technology, and the poor people who originally would have made their modest living by working for those people now are replaced by robots. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do they do? His argument is that by providing a universal basic income, the government has a role to make sure that doesn't happen. In a society with universal basic income, not that you'd feel rich or that you wouldn't have to do anything with your $10,000 or a year or whatever it is, but that you would have enough money that you'd be able to take risk, that someone would have enough money that they don't have to be homeless, that homelessness would essentially be voluntarily if every person in this country was given that much money every year. And that would allow people to take risks. Somebody's kind of in a trap if they're, say, a single mother who has to take care of two kids and has no skills, and they might have to work two full-time jobs right now, and they'll have no time for school that would allow them to make more. And this is kind of the trap.
Right.
At least theoretically, if you ask a proponent of UBI, such as Zoltan, that somebody would say, okay, I have enough of a base that I can work and to get above that, but also I can get my education, and then I'll be a more productive person eventually. It's just kind of that trap at the bottom, but that through sort of legislation, through trying to create an equitable society in some way, that could be achieved. But the other analogy is that when something like the iPhone came out, it seems so expensive, right? Somebody might have actually made the same criticism. What if only the rich have iPhones and poor people are stuck with flip phones?
Right.
Now flip phones are almost virtually obsolete, and you can get a little bit older of an iPhone, maybe not the 7 Plus or what, you know, whatever the current thing is now, but you could probably get an iPhone 4 for well under $100 at this point. So there's also the argument that capitalism drives prices down for everything.
Yeah.
Manufacturers of technology aren't going to try to make them available just to the 1% because the 1% is only 1% of society. Mm-hmm. You want it to be at a low enough price point that most of the, you know, people in the country can afford it. If you can make a product affordable by 90% of the country, then you have 90 times the customers as if it was only for the rich.
I mean, that is true. The only caveat I would throw in is that, you know, it depends on the technology we're talking about, because if it's something, you know, that's extreme life enhancing, you know, we're not talking about an iPhone necessarily. There may be people that want to hold on to that and not share it, and vice versa. You know, the argument of absolute gains versus relative gains, which is, you know, people, you know, they're less interested if I have a universal basic income of $10,000. I'm more interested in my income relative to everyone else in society. But it's, you know, this gets into some really interesting questions. I think it'd be quite messy. My own view would be that you'd have a little bit of everything in a world like that. But it's interesting.
That envy, that feeling of I have to have more than everyone else, though, is what drives accomplishment in the first place. It's why we have iPhones.
True.
If everybody was satisfied with nobody is satisfied with their present condition. Everybody who's middle class wishes, and but I would say most people, it's in human nature. Mm. Someone in the middle class would like to be in the upper middle class. Somebody who is very poor would probably like to be kind of working class. Yeah. You know, everybody kind of would like to be the next level up, but that's why we have innovation. That's why we create value. That's why we have growth in society.
Right?
We target 4% more growth every single year. That happens because everybody wants more. And that's mostly a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's mostly a good thing. It's also, there are societies like the United States where that is, you know, that's possible, and mobility, you know, between classes is, I mean, that's what the whole American dream is predicated upon, right?
Right.
It's interesting how that would play out in some, you know, in some other countries. But yeah, it's a very, yeah, we're heading into some interesting debates, I think, about some of this stuff. I wanted to bring it back to your documentary.
Sure.
And what, you know, what are you planning to do with it? Who are you interested in talking to? What are you planning to share and show, all of that good stuff?
Right. So the documentary, right now I'm fundraising on Indiegogo, and I'm sure you can attach a link. Your viewers will have some way to figure out where that is. It currently is at, I think I've raised $4,100, more or less.
Okay.
And my goal is 20,000.
Okay.
And I only have 14 days left of the campaign. So I may have to seek investment or money in ways other than the Indiegogo. But the Indiegogo is a really big start. And unlike Kickstarter, I get all of the money that I raise, even if I don't hit the goal.
Okay.
But so I'm looking to get as much as I can from backers like that. Perks sort of include special thanks, various different types of credits, poster signed by me, DVDs, special thanks on social media, etc. So definitely check that out. But in terms of the movie, its goals, etc., in a way, I don't know what exactly I'll be capturing yet, because I hope for it to be a journey. I hope to kind of tell it as a story of almost like going down the rabbit hole in a way.
Yeah.
That I'm starting with, you know, and already it's very fringe compared to what anybody else knows about the topic, but I'm starting at the conference, a fairly public conference that anybody who wants to could, of body hackers. And and I hope to interview with them, talk to people there about their philosophy, ask them in their own words, who should I be talking to about this? In a way, I'm actually hesitant to just research it and talk directly to the people that I want to represent it, because I don't think I'm qualified to say who should talk about this. I think I need to ask people in the movement, normal people in the movement, who are the leaders that you want me to talk to. So I already know I'm going to interview Zoltan Isfahan extensively and talk about the Transhumanist Party. I'm going to be going to Body Hacking Con. I hope to speak to the Church of Perpetual Life. There's also actually several cyborg rights nonprofits, which is very strange.
Yeah, what are those?
Not really an issue yet.
Cyborg rights nonprofits.
I think it's a nonprofit called the Center for. I think there is one literally called the Center for Cyborg Rights.
Okay.
I know that in Britain there is a organization, the Institute for Post-Human Studies, that essentially talks about these sorts of issues as well. But I want to talk to people who have already had some kind of a conflict in this area. And the problem is that it's just starting to emerge. But I've actually read one case, and I won't give the person's name because I haven't confirmed yet that I'll be talking to them. But very simply put, I have encountered online somebody who had divorced from their spouse, and they're a body hacker, and they had joint custody of their child, and the mom just sued to get full custody because of the fact that he's a body hacker. And so he can claim legitimately, the state is trying to take away my child because I'm a cyborg, right? And he's running a fundraiser, you know, to get money on, you know, to fight for his defense on that. But so there's an actual case, right, that already there's just starting to happen, not common at all, but somebody who actually has to fight for their rights as a cyborg. And it begs the question, could this be considered a civil right in the way that society thinks of them in the future? Could the Civil Rights Act be amended to add, you know, there's gender, sexuality, race, gender identity? Could that actually add a cyborg status? You can't discriminate against somebody on the basis of the computer chip in their hand.
Right.
those are the sorts of political issues that I want to see the little sprouts, little seeds of political fighting that's already happening over those topics. And so I want to tell that as a story. And the ultimate goal is, because my kind of projection is that these topics will become more mainstream later, that once this technology is big enough that people will start fighting over it just like they did over stem cells. And I would like for, because nobody knows right now, less than probably 1 in 50 would know what transhumanism means. I would like to have this film be something that is not just entertaining and interesting and educational now, but also that people can look back at it when they say, how did we get to this point without knowing this was coming? Where did this movement start? I kind of want this to be kind of the first draft or one of the first drafts of the history of this movement.
Right. Like a reference point or the benchmark for when people start to, you know, wake up and realize that this is a thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Are you looking primarily at the United States? Are you thinking about what transhumanism looks like outside of the US?
It really depends on what kind of money I get. So it seems that traveling is difficult. absent more money, it's pretty hard to travel. I can say that for my trip to Texas, I'm already spending probably a quarter of the money that I've already raised just to get to sort of one event. And I want and I know I'm going to travel to interview Zoltan, who lives in California, the Church of Perpetual Life's in Florida. So I'm going to be
right.
I know that I'm already going to be traveling a lot, but traveling overseas is really expensive.
Right.
I would like to observe this on an international level. I mean, even in the really extreme, I mean, if I was able to get access to Chinese who are doing the genetic editing, if I could see the kind of frontier of that could even be somewhere that I would travel to. But at this point, the only confirmed locations are in the United States.
I mean, it'll be a very good start. The two things that did that I did think about from an international perspective, one is around conflict. So you know, the use of some of these technologies to carry out conflict, military incursion, or espionage, or all kinds of things like that. And the second one is just the environmental question. If we are talking about life extension, well, what are demographics going to look like? How many people are we going to have in 100 years' time on this planet, and what does that mean? So those are all both really interesting questions, worth exploring. Obviously you'll be speaking to a range of very interesting and well-informed people on this topic, it would be very interesting to cover some of that stuff.
Right, and it tends to be, and interestingly, the transhumanists tend to be fairly anti-war, anti-military. Yep. Conflict. The Transhumanist Party platform claims that one of the big ways that they can, fund science is by defunding the military, that getting less military engagements and, let's do space travel and body hacking instead.
That is a good argument there. Conversely, a lot of technologies have come out of the U.S. military.
Right.
That have found civilian use, but that's not to say that that couldn't have happened in another manner. So that's really right. That's really interesting. So you'll be traveling the country, speaking to a range of people, and just exploring the concept of transhumanism. It sounds like a lot of fun.
I think it will be quite an adventure. I'm sure that I will see a lot of things that I couldn't have even imagined even just a few months ago. So I think that this is going to be a really fun story. At the moment, I don't know how I'm going to release it. Maybe I independently release it. It's possible that I could try to get it onto broadcast, maybe even Netflix. But at the moment, I'm pretty free from any sort of corporate influence. I want it to be a grassroots effort, right? By doing fundraising the way that I'm doing it, crowdfunding, I'm not being bought out by anybody.
That's very important. That's
to the biases of the mainstream media. I don't want anybody to use this as a. I'm not going to let the Catholic Church buy my film and then make it a condemnation of the movement. Nor am I going to let a pro-transhumanist group buy out what I'm doing. I hope for it to be objectively kind of telling the story and looking at all sides of the issue. But that's why I need the public's help to make it happen. If I'm going to be objective, if I'm not going to let it be sold out to anybody, then I need the grassroots to support.
That's very important. And, you know, I think that's why, that's certainly one of the reasons why I started this podcast, is to start to reach out to people from a very grassroots base. And I think, speaking of technology, you know, we have a great opportunity. We're living in a great time to be able to do exactly the kind of thing that you're doing. So is there anything else that we haven't covered off about the documentary, yourself, transhumanism, that you'd like to mention?
Not in particular, other than to make sure that everybody, you know, goes to the Indiegogo. The project on there is called Transhuman: A Documentary. If anyone wants to ask me questions, I'm totally available. If people want to ask me questions about the film, anybody who emails me, sends me a tweet, you know, I'd be willing to Skype, talk on the phone, email back and forth, you know, send a carrier pigeon, whatever. I guess the other shout out I didn't get to mention, that I actually had brought on as a co-producer, Michelle Battle Fisher, who I believe was on your—
Yes, she was. She was on
your podcast previously. So I just wanted to, I had mentioned Zoltan, I had mentioned Alejandro, who's going to be filming with me. So I wanted to be able to give that sort of shout out. So she's a co-producer. She's going to help me do a lot in the realm of research and really with some of the academic stuff, right? I just graduated college, you know, and I've taught a few guest classes at universities. And if I'm very lucky, I might actually end up being an adjunct professor next semester. But Michelle actually has an extensive academic life so far. She's written a book about organizational complexity. She writes a lot about these topics. So Michelle Battle Fisher will be participating in this and really bringing the academic angle that I think will add some level of intellectualism to the project.
I think it's a great addition. She was on the show. We talked about systems thinking, and it sounds to me like that's a very good lens through which to view all of this stuff. Because as you say, you know, you've got all kinds of different types of people, and you've got kind of, I don't know if you call it this fundamentalist wing of transhumanism. You've got the body hackers, you've got all this stuff, genetic engineering, you know, and it's all interacting, but just making sense of it is, I think would require someone with a systems thinking background that Michelle certainly has. So I think that'll help your project.
Right, absolutely. So I'm looking forward to seeing if any of your audience wants to get involved, contribute to the project, ask any questions. I'm available on Twitter at Ford Fisher, at FordFisher. I'm also on Facebook, Ford Fisher, FISCHER. It's got the blue check mark next to it on Facebook, but not Twitter. I'm famous enough for Facebook, but not famous enough for Twitter.
That might change.
So the verified one on Facebook is the one you can reach me at if that's your social media of choice.
Very cool. I'll put all the links into the show notes, and I'll urge my listeners to check out the project and to support it. And I wanted to wish you all the best with this. It sounds like a really great thing to get involved in, best of luck with everything. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye for now. Fascinating, right? Ford's Indiegogo campaign closes on January the 26th, and this episode goes out on January the 16th. So if you found what you heard to be interesting, there's time to support it. And I think it would be a very worthwhile project. You can check out newstoshare.com. That's news2share.com to find out more. And as always, I've got all the links to how you can support Ford's project, as well as all the show notes on allthingsrisk.co.uk. It's a very interesting project, and I wish Ford the best of luck. Once again, if you liked this show or if you have any feedback, send it to me, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Please, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, particularly on iTunes. It does help a lot. We'll be back next week with another great conversation. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.